Let me begin in another place, the introduction to Nectar of Devotion. There, Prabhupada says that every living entity, every spirit soul, has a desire to love. So this is on the spiritual platform. We all have prema, that love on the spiritual level, is love for Krishna. And he says that this desire wants to expand without limit. However, when we take that love that's been for Krishna and repose it on things in this world, it cannot expand. It becomes blocked, checked, and baffled. And we become frustrated. Prabhupada gave the called our situation in the material world an incompatible situation, because he says the knower is spiritual, but what is known is material. And naturally we seek for those things that belong to the spiritual realm, but we're looking for them in the material world. It's like that old joke about a guy that lost his keys, and somebody sees him searching around the front of his house. Says, "Where did you lose him?" "He's over by my car." "Why are you searching here?" "Well, the light's better here." So we're looking in the wrong place for what we really want. That's our situation. So we try to love. I'm speaking about love here because I think when we're talking about heart, it's like really the place of the soul. And there is this love for Krishna that's there, which ultimately our process is to invoke, reawaken. Now, that is an interesting, if we go from Prabhupada and Nectar of Devotion to Sigmund Freud. Freud wrote a book called Civilization and Its Discontents. The first part of that book, the first like 30 pages, is a long discussion of why happiness is impossible in the material world. It's for human beings. And he's pretty good at it. He eliminates all the different possibilities. First, he talks about gross animal satisfactions. He says they're really, really intense, but very brief, and they often cause trouble in their sequence to them, the things that follow. And he says they can only be really enjoyed for a certain time of life, when you're young and your senses and your body works very well. He says, so that's really not, doesn't really ultimately satisfy. We become more dissatisfied ultimately by gross animal satisfactions. He said, so the other solution that people go to get rid of these difficulties is they put their feelings into higher things like art and music. And he said, these pleasures of the mind or the intellect, they do last longer. When you're very old, you can contemplate the abstract beauties of mathematics, and you can listen to Bach two-part variations for a very long time and appreciate them and so on. But Freud says they lose in intensity. They're refined, they're not gross, but also they're not as intense. Then finally he turns to love. He says, like many popular songs and popular literature, they urge us that love will bring us happiness, that with love we'll find satisfaction, That we should fall in love with somebody and give them our whole heart. And then he says, however, when you love somebody, you are never more open to suffering. and quickly, people learn the lesson of this. Because, of course, if it's romantic love, the love object can turn against you, and you're broken hearted, or you're separated by some other thing. Just stop. Oh, it's still going. If you have children that you fall in love with, they sometimes they die. They're called hostages to fortune for good reason, because you're in anxiety all the time. What's going to happen? And then your children also grow old. And the poet Yeats wondered what would a young mother think if she could see that child with a shape upon her lap with 60 or more winters on its head. Would that she think that a compensation for the pang of his birth or the uncertainty of his setting forth? So he says love doesn't work either, because you're never so much open. And of course, Western literature is full of cautionary tales of people that loved very, very intensely. And actually, we all know that this intense romantic love is really the property of young people. Because after it's over, you say, I'll never do that again. You got hurt too much and too badly. And so as you grow older, you kind of wall yourself off. You become a cautious person. And this has the effect of the withering of the heart. So our desire to love goes out. It gets invested in various things or activities. And we ultimately suffer disappointment. We form relationships for happiness, and those relationships, well, they always fail. That one of the very best definitions of death I ever read was in some astrology, paperback astrology book before I became a devotee. And I was kind of interested in astrology in those days. But when I saw this definition of death, I thought, what is, you know, it's like picking up gold from a dirty place. The definition was death was the ultimate failure to perpetuate relationships. And any relationship on the bodily platform is subjected to death. The ultimate failure to perpetuate relationships. So we're living in this place where everything is temporary. Spiritually, what we want is eternal, because we're eternal spirit soul. We want eternal happiness. We want eternal relationships. We keep looking for it. What do they sing in the songs? Oh, I love you to the end of time. Our love will never die. You know, ha ha ha. they sing it anyway. You know, everybody wants them. They want that movie. You know, the Hollywood movie, boy meets girl, then there's some trouble, they lose his girl, they get his girl again, and then they go off into the sunset, the music swells up, the end, and they lived happily ever after. Keep the camera rolling. Yeah, Romeo and Juliet's a great one, because that's what happens to love, right? It's a total, complete, and ends in death. In both parties, these are cautionary tales.
There's actually a sequel that was a comedy of what would happen
if they kept the. Oh, really? Yeah. Okay.
That was actually more of a tragedy.
Yeah, than dying young, right? Right. I can just imagine, yeah. That's a movie that writes itself. Huh? Yeah. So those are your choices, die young or live to your old. Either way, it's a disaster for your love, right? So this is what happens in the world. There's just not any object to our love, any corresponding things, because it really is something that we want for Krishna, and so the heart gets hard. When I was a new devotee, and at that time we used to make our own deity dresses. This is before we sent people to India, and my wife and I went down to this section of the city, a whole street of cloth merchants, and some of them very high end cloth merchants. You get some really fancy stuff. And so we were down there one day in this one shop we'd never been to before, and the proprietor was there, and he was this, you know, kind of grim-looking Jewish guy in his 60s or 70s even. And he's watching me walk around and look at various clothes, and he's like curious because I'm a devotee. He hasn't, you know, when he asked me something about what I was doing, and I said I was... worshipping a group as a practice bhakti yoga, love of God, or something like that, you know. And he watches me for a while, and then he comes up to me and he says, "You want to know my philosophy of life, kid?" It's really funny, you know. I mean, he watches that he finally wants to. Oh, so here's somebody he could talk to about the meaning of life. "You want to know my philosophy of life?" And I said, "Yeah, what is it?" And he said, "People stink." That's what he said. "People stink." And I looked at him more closely, and I could see the history in his face and his posture. You know, here was a guy whose partners cheated him, whose kids hated his guts. His wife either left them or they're living in the same house but don't talk to each other. You know, he is like a very embittered man. People stink. That's his experience with people. Right? They stink. And I thought, how can I ever convince this person that God is a person? So that's what happens to him. People stink. If he's ever becomes interested in spiritual life, it would be something impersonal. Because Prabhupada mentioned, Krishna says attachment, fear, and anger. And Prabhupada says as fear is they are afraid of becoming persons again. Because their idea of persons is based on unfortunate experience. Like this. So this is one reason why gradually the heart becomes hard. It's a kind of survival mechanism. We open our hearts and it becomes wounded. So we are afraid. Now Krishna consciousness calls upon us to fully make ourselves available to Krishna. It means, first of all, when it comes to Krishna, we have to have complete trust. I mean, when you love somebody, you give them your trust. You make yourself vulnerable. That's what love means. That all the defenses and all the guard things you have on guard, you put them aside. That's easy for young people to do, for the first time. A few times. We put that all aside because we trust somebody completely. Our whole happiness. I mean, that's what really, the first time I was 13 years old and I fell in love with the most beautiful girl in the world, and it looked like it was reciprocated at least for a while. And I was in this state like I'd never been in before. You know, I couldn't stop thinking about her. And one part of me was saying, my God, your whole life depends upon what this is. She was not so bright. And she had blonde hair. to fill out the Christian name. But my whole life depends on what goes on inside of her head. You know, how can I lose so much control? Of course, it was what. Anyway, I learned my lesson. But it requires that trust that it's safe to love, that as we say, to surrender. So that's why it's really important to study about Krishna. What we have is the testimony of people who have surrendered to Krishna and who have loved Krishna without any reservation. Especially through Lord Chaitanya, he doesn't hold anything back of what it's like, and we see it. And we also learn the characteristics of Krishna. Although he is the supreme controller, he's prema vashah. One of his qualities, he becomes controlled by the love of his devotees. Because it's very interesting. I mean, the real deep purport of yayatam mam prapajyate tam sataiva bhajamyaham. As they surrender to me, really the word is worship. Bhajami. I worship them. Prabhupada translates it, I reward them accordingly. But surrender to Krishna means I give myself to Krishna. So what's his proportionate response? He gives himself to the devotees. He becomes controlled by the devotees. Not by the devotees exactly, but by their love. So he also has to trust. And so that's why Krishna consciousness is given out not so freely. Because Krishna gives himself to the devotees as the devotees give themselves to him. And he becomes controlled by the love of his devotees. That's why it says, as Prabhupada puts it, that devotional service is transcendentally more powerful than Krishna. So in some ways, Krishna is he's two sides of everything. He's the supreme controller, but on the other side, he's the supreme controlled. Because there's when you're the controller, it's a one-sided relationship, and there's also virtues to being on the passive end of things. So he's both of these. So we should study his nature very carefully to see what Krishna, what he says about us, and also what his devotees say about him. And just the more we get to know Krishna. There was a pop song when I was a kid, to know him is to love him, and I do. Well, this is true about Krishna. If you know Krishna, you'll fall in love with him. The other part of this, Maharaj was discussing how sense gratification hardens the heart. Because we become selfish. And sometimes it looks like love, but it's sense gratification. I know somebody very well, elderly lady, and since her husband died, she's had a dog. A dog has a fairly short lifespan. So like every 10 years or something, the dog gets really old and won't be house trained anymore. And so that dog becomes her dearest companion and a constant associate. But then at a certain point, the dog is really old, is killed. It's very sad for her to do this, put away, as they say. The dog is put away. And then she gets a new one. And then the same thing with this dog and constant companion and dear most friend and everything. And I mean, they have dogs trained like this, therapy dogs, to give people some kind of relationship with a living being, you know. But then again, kill, then another dog, and then everything's over. As soon as the new dog comes, you know, everything is transferred to the new dog. And so it goes. So a lot of times what we say is love, because love means it's you to want to be concerned for the other. But when I really, the other is just an instrument for my happiness, that's not love. That's lust. So sense gratification is this selfishness where you're really concerned to use the other for your own happiness, your own sense gratification. So it does become selfish. I lose one person. There's replacements coming along. You know, I could replace everybody with somebody else and keep on going like this. So, and it makes the heart, and when our sense gratification is baffled, we become angry, resentful, and so on, and that increases things. So there's another aspect to sense gratification. What it really means is that if we analyze it very carefully, we'll see that this sense gratification is the act of atheism. Because there's a lot of people who believe in God, and really do believe in God, but their primary aim in life is nevertheless sense gratification. But let us say it's regulated to some extent by the laws of Scripture. Even as regulated sense gratification, still there's some more or less some rebellion against God. God is not the center. God is often still you're the center of enjoyment. God is orbiting around you, and his business is to keep the thing going for you. If he doesn't keep his bargain and you don't get sense gratification, then you become angry at God, and the ultimate expression of anger is he doesn't exist, which is basically I could kill him if it's possible. So, but if we look at what sense gratification is, we bring our senses into contact with the objects. Samsparsaja, Krishna says in the 5th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Yehi Samsparsaja Bhoga. There's bhoga, enjoyment, that happens when we bring our senses into contact with the objects. He says that enjoyment, dukkha yonaya evate, is in fact the source of all suffering. Which is interesting in itself. It means the world is just the opposite from what we think. But if we look at this, so if we look at this act, there's senses and sense objects. You bring them together. And first of all, there's a sensation of pleasure. Now, as far as I can see, just that sensation of pleasure is not yet sense gratification. Because you could just tolerate it the same way you might tolerate pain. It's just something that happens. I mean, right now, every time I inhale a lungful of air, that's sense gratification. You can't live without sense gratification. The senses just need something to stay alive, to keep the body alive, and so you can just satisfy the senses to a certain point, but never not actually become the enjoyer. But if what happens with actual sense gratification is that there's pleasure, and then there's a kind of secondary mental motion where one takes possession of that pleasure and the object that gives it. Because what happens next is there's the equivalent of thinking, now I'm enjoying. We don't maybe say it. Sometimes we really say it big. there's a satisfaction just at enjoying. And we puff up. We feel more alive and more real. We puff up. This is what happens. This is called acquiring a false ego. I am the enjoyer. And people, they advertise it. When people go out to enjoy in the streets and the party places, they make sure they're loud. So everyone can see that I am the enjoyer. A man wants to have sexual relations with a beautiful woman. It's not enough that he does that. He has to take her out at night in a very revealing dress and take her with her so the other men can say, look at that, he has that woman. And he parades her around in front of everybody so all the other men can be envious because I am the enjoyer. This is the way it goes, right? So this is I am the enjoyer. And then, of course, if you want to enjoy, the sense object cannot be allowed to get away or not perform in the way you want. And you want to keep a steady stream of sense objects coming, so I am the controller. So therefore, there's this mentality in the act of sense gratification of I am the enjoyer and I am the controller. Now that means that we have taken the position of God. This is why I call it that. It's the act of atheism. I am the enjoyer. I am the controller. We have somehow become competitors with God. Either we've replaced him, if we carry it out all the way to its logical conclusion, or we shove him off into the margins. If we're pious, but it's, in any case, there's no surrender to God, and so that's another way that we become that why it's necessary to give up this competition with God. Now, what we do in Bhakti Yoga is retrain or reprogram our mind by use of intelligence. That we now look at God as the enjoyer and controller. That's why taking only Krishna prasadam, only eating things that are offered first to Krishna, so that even when I go, like the very basic act of sense gratification necessary for keeping me alive as it is to breathe, I then take that activity and turn it into devotional service, my most basic animal activities of life. Prabhupada talked about hearing. In this context, he was talking about hearing Bhagavatam, but the same thing about Bhagavatam applies to chanting of the holy names, the cultivation of Bhagavatam. He says that Bhagavatam has to be heard with rapt attention. If it's heard with rapt attention, then you will see Krishna directly in the pages, because the book about Krishna and Krishna himself are none different, and you will meet Krishna directly in the pages of Bhagavatam. Same as when we chant japa. Krishna and Krishna's name are the same. So we want to chant japa, to hear the holy name, to speak the holy name in a way that Krishna appears. So this has to be done with heightened attention, to turn up the volume of our attention. Because we can pay attention to something, but under certain circumstances, we really pay attention. So, to pay attention to Krishna, Prabhupada says, that to be, one has to, in rapt attention, one has to be pure in mind. And we cannot be pure in mind unless we are pure in our activities. Because what makes our attention waver is all the other things going on in the mind that pull us away from Krishna. The impure reminiscences, the memories of sense gratification. The mind has to be pure. But if our activities are not pure, then we're pumping like some old factory pumping filthy smoke into the air, you know, by our impure activity. So we have to stop doing that. So our activities have to be pure. And then Prabhupada said, no one can be pure in action who's not pure in eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Or as he said, fearing. In other words, the most basic animal activities of life have to be done in a pure way. So that's why when we come to prasadam, we're talking about eating. And when we start cooking and offering everything to Krishna, when I go shopping and I look at the different items on sale, I gradually become trained to see, not that this will be tasty for me, but will Krishna enjoy this? Will Krishna like this? And so I now look at the former object of my enjoyment as something that I would simply evaluate: is it good for Krishna's senses or my sense or not, and not for my senses. Or similarly, when my wife and I went out deity shopping to buy cloth for the deity, we are thinking. In this case, it was Jagannath. How will Jagannath look in this? How will Subhadra look in this? Sometimes we'd be looking at some cloth, and the merchant would come up and kind of try to drape it over my wife, and she'd say, "No, no, no, don't do it." And in this way, you could do those things that you like to see beautiful cloth and appreciate the quality of the work and everything. But not without any idea of your own sense gratification. So it was very useful. And when you become a preacher, you meet somebody and you don't evaluate the person. Would this be an attractive sexual partner or not? Will this be a socially a good person for me to know, a socially bad person? All you want to know is, can I bring this person to Krishna for Krishna to enjoy? Or not. So this we retrain our whole outlook on life. So in this way, by all these other things, the mind becomes, the actions become pure, and then the mind becomes pure. And this is all part of the opening of the heart. Prabhupada uses this phrase in the Bhagavad Gita, the regulative principles of freedom. It sounds like a contradiction. but these principles cure the disease. So there's a cardiac disease mentioned in the Bhagavatam, Kama Hrit Rogam. Sense gratification is a disease of the heart. It's called a disease of the heart, Kama Hrit Rogam. So that's the disease everyone is suffering from. So we have to cure the heart of its disease so that it can be free to love Krishna, which is what we want. So by these activities and by chanting Hare Krishna. In the proper way. Again, to people, we did something that when most people will look on what we did yesterday, they would see that as suffering, just as and total boredom. But most of us, we went on quite an adventure that was really, really interesting and very, very fruitful and. For long periods, a good time, And we can also see that in the future I could do this in such a way that it would be an even better time. And this is the way that love of God develops. One last thing. This verse that Maharaj told us about, 11:20, 27, and 28. Even if you've not read the 11th canto, if we've studied the Bhagavad Gita, we know this verse because Prabhupada puts it in chapter 3, text 31 in the Gita. It's there in the purport without saying what it is. That verse says, Krishna says, those people who execute their duties according to my injunction and who follow this teaching faithfully without envy become free from the bondage of fruitive actions. So Prabhupada says here at the end of the purport, it's a very short purport, he says, first of all, he talks about people who will not be liberated. And then he says, but an ordinary man with firm faith, Japta Shraddha, that Shraddha, Japta Shraddha, that with beginning with faith, firm faith in the eternal injunctions of the Lord, even though unable to execute those orders. So that's what that verse, the 11th canto, is about. Becomes liberated from the bondage of the law of karma. In the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may not fully discharge the injunctions of the Lord. But because one is not resentful of this principle, that is to say that the Lord's injunctions should be followed. Oh, why has Krishna imposed this on it? Why is he giving me these regular principles that are so hard to follow? Why 16 rounds? Well, you know, so many people I've heard them express these resentfulness of the injunctions of the Lord. But because one is not resentful of this principle and works sincerely without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, pritaha, you should not be depressed, he will surely be promoted to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness. So that's a kind of a nice little summary of this verse, right? In the beginning of Krishna consciousness, because it says in the commentary right away, this describes the beginning stages of Krishna consciousness. In the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may not fully discharge the injunctions of the Lord. But because one is not resentful of this principle, that the injunctions are to be followed, and works sincerely without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, he will surely be promoted to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness. So that's a nice place that this verse. It's so funny. It also tells us how Prabhupada thought in verses a lot of times. And he won't stop and say where it is or where it came from or anything, but he'll just give it like this. So these are the regulative principles of freedom philosophically speaking, this desire we feel to enjoy in the world is so strong. We should understand that's how much we love Krishna. Because originally, that desire to enjoy, which is called kama, its original form is prema. When a soul comes to the material world, this prema comes into contact with the motive passion and then becomes manifest as kama, a desire to enjoy in the world. So with Krishna consciousness, our process is taking that kama and turning it back to what it originally is, love for Krishna. The Freudians would call this sublimation. Sublimate means to lift up. But his idea, because he was an atheist, was that that he didn't know that it's originally sublimated. It's not some artificial position. That the original form of this karma is actually prema. So that it can be... because people who followed Freud, a lot of them thought it was unhealthy not to give expression and put your desires into action. They thought that our desires for enjoyment were like water in a boiler that was being heated up. And the pressure would build up and up and up. And if you didn't let it out, you would explode. So therefore you had to let your sense gratifications, only healthy, somewhat controlled release of sense gratification. Otherwise there'd be a blow up. So for example, in the 60s, we had a slogan, make love, not war. We thought the generals in the Pentagon didn't have enough sex. Well, this is totally deluded. But anyway, we thought that they were, because the hippies were out there, you know, about marriage, anything like that. We were having enough sex, but the generals in the Pentagon were sexually frustrated. And therefore, their anger was being expressed by this desire to shoot phallic missiles at other people. So that was the theory, you know. But it doesn't work. In Krishna consciousness, this is not repression, but it's the reconversion of this lust into what originally is love for Krishna. Where Freud thought that when things were sublimated, they lose in power. But actually, the intensity increases. There's nothing as intense as the ecstasy of Lord Chaitanya that he expressed and that was also experienced by his followers. It didn't lose an intensity. It gained an intensity. Why? Because the object is eternal. As I said, if you really want intense material satisfaction, it only happens when you're young and then you learn what happens and then you'll never do that again. So actually we end up, just for self-protection, holding our love back because we know we're in danger of suffering anytime it's there. So but that love can really open up and really expand to its full intensity only with Krishna. So therefore we're fully satisfied. And so that's what we all want is this opening of the heart. Okay, thank you.
Doing the satisfying the senses and gratifying the senses.
Yeah, that's right.
So how, you know, how to see that? Because I'm okay. I'm just.
Yeah. Well, you can cheat. Cheating by the method known as drinking water underwater while taking a bath on a fast day, right? So you have to have an honest disposition. Prabhupada told us, like, when we drink water, we should say, thank you, Krishna, for satisfying my thirst. At least whenever we drink water, we should remember where it comes from. I mean, part of it is, the real injunction is always remember Krishna, never forget him. When there's sense gratification, there's just two. It's a dyad. There's me and the sense object. In devotional service, there's always a triad. The Krishna has to be the middle term in any relationship. And I haven't forgotten Krishna. So when I drink water, I can also think Krishna says, up. Rasoham apsukantaya. I am rasa in water. And so we can remember Krishna. He's given us so many ways not to forget him. And whenever I breathe, I really should be conscious at every minute that Krishna is sustaining my life because he's actually the prana. That's when I digest food, Krishna is the fire of digestion. I mean, this is what meant to be Krishna conscious, that in every act of my senses, the sense object, I see Krishna is there. And that if I'm using my body fully for Krishna's service, then Krishna's sustaining this body. I'm dependent upon him at every minute. We are. The basic things we need to stay alive is also provided by Krishna. The earth I walk on is given by Krishna. The air I breathe is given by Krishna. And if we love Krishna at every minute, we're just overwhelmed with gratitude. Neither do I think that I'm owed anything. So this is all a gift from Krishna. So it's just cultivating that mentality. And remember that the chanting that we do for japa is just the concentrated time of exclusive devotion to Krishna. And meditation on Krishna, but actually it should not stop. Kirtaniya Sadaharahi means always. Krishna is always to be remembered. That's the regular principle. And not to be forgotten, not for a moment. Najatuchit, not for any. Remember Krishna always, and don't forget him, not for a second. Even for a second. That's the real thing. So this when we do the discipline of japa, is just a concentrated time of remembering Krishna, which should not end. And now our most intense remembrance of Krishna we may have in the early stages of japa. Pretty soon, that's the way we are all the time, and it becomes deeper and deeper. Because everyone agrees,
yeah,
right?
Prabhupada
said silence means you agree.
I thought you had your
face. I didn't hear the beginning of your class, so maybe you spoke about it. You were talking about how the material life is useless. But then if it comes, to the loving relationship between the bodies, I don't know if you talk about it. I remember during one of the previous retreats, somebody was saying, I think Sachinanda Maharaj is somewhere, I think Yagyavalkya, I don't remember, said that two main needs of a human being is to love and to be loved.
To love, oh, okay.
To love, to give love.
And get to receive love, right?
Right, that are actually the main needs. So, my question is, it was Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj who said that, let's say the relationship between one wife and the husband is like preparation for the ultimate relationship with Krishna, in the sense that I'm actually learning how to serve. I don't want to understand it in the wrong way, because I know he wrote in his book that, and I see that such a purification and such a, I learned so much in the Grihastha Ashram. I just need to give up so many of my misconceptions. Is it like preparation, or I don't know how to think about it, so it's not sahajiya, or have a proper understanding. And the
whole anyway. You give a whole grihastha class
in 2 minutes? It can be done as preparation, and it can be done as forgetfulness. I think that being a brahmachari or a sannyasi, if you do that right, is even more preparation, because it said that Mahaprabhu gave up his family life because he was going to be loving more people. It increased his scope for loving more people. So if your idea of not being married is a bachelor or a single person in the way they do in the modern West, male or female, where basically you're simply concerned with your own satisfaction, then marriage is a big renunciation. I remember the day before I got married, I was sitting with a friend talking, and I said, I'll never be able to go into bars and pick up girls again. And then I realized I'd never done that, actually. Maybe in a coffee shop once in a while, but not bars anyway. You know, but I felt like this big, you know, and to my wife and I got married, the same one I'm married to now, my between my junior and senior year of college. And it was considered by everybody to be a supreme act of renunciation that we were actually getting married. My male friends were like very distressed because their girlfriends were going to want them to get married. And it was such a strange, quaint thing to do that the dean of women had my wife and I over for dinner just to see what was going on, that we actually got married. It wasn't because of me, it was because of her. She was just pious, but she wouldn't live with me unless we were married, that's all. I mean, it was just so old-fashioned. So we got married, but people thought it was like super renounced and austere and everything like that. So when I joined ISKCON, I said later to people, you know, well, when I got married, it was the pious thing to do because at least in those days, you know, it was like falling down into the dark well, you know, all the bad side was like really emphasized. So it can be done that way where you can't, especially you have children, you know, say there's a husband and wife and you have to care for each other and be not so selfish. And then if you got a little twosome going, that's really selfish. Then you have children, and then that's a whole other thing. So it can be like that. But in a marriage, one may get married for reasons of material happiness. But ultimately, if it's Krishna conscious, the same thing. Krishna has to be the center term. I have to see my wife as not my wife, but as Krishna's servant. And the children not as my children, but that we have a bhakta program where we're bringing up children to serve Krishna. Then it becomes not so selfish. That's what's necessary. You want to say anything about that particular topic?
You said it very well.
Okay. Okay.